for being the way I am.
I don't care if you're gay,
Philip says, dropping that big fat if like Henry hasn't specifically told him. I care that you've made this choice with him. He cuts his eyes sharply to Alex as if he finally exists in the same room as this conversation. Someone with a fucking target on his back. To be so stupid and naive and selfish as to think it wouldn't completely fuck us all.
I knew, Philip. Christ, Henry says. I knew it could ruin everything. I was terrified of exactly this. But how could I have predicted? How?
As I said, naive,
Philip tells him.
This is the life we live, Henry. You've always known it. I've tried to tell you. I wanted to be a good brother to you, but you don't bloody listen. It's time to remember your place in this family. Be a man. Stand up and take responsibility. Fix this. For once in your life, don't be a coward.
Henry flinches like he's been physically slapped. Alex can see it now. This is how he was broken down over the years. Maybe not always as explicitly, but always there, always implied. Remember your place. And he does the thing Alex loves so much. He sticks his chin out, steeling himself up.
I'm not a coward, he says, and I don't want to fix it.
Philip slants a harsh, humorless laugh at him.
You don't know what you're talking about. You can't possibly know.
Fuck off, Philip. I love him, Henry says.
Oh, you love him, do you?
It's so patronizing that Alex's hand twitches into a fist under the table.
What exactly do you intend to do then, Henry? Marry him? Make him the Duchess of Cambridge? The first son of the United Bloody States? Fourth in line to be Queen of England?
I'll fucking abdicate, Henry says, voice rising. I don't care.
You wouldn't dare,
Philip spits back.
We have a great uncle who abdicated because he was a fucking Nazi. So it'd be hardly the worst reason anyone's done it, would it?
Henry's yelling now, and he's out of his chair, hands shaking, towering over Philip, and Alex notices that he's actually taller.
What are we even defending here, Philip? What kind of legacy? What kind of family that says, we'll take the murder, we'll take the raping and pillaging and the colonizing, we'll scrub it up nice and neat in a museum, but oh no, you're a bloody poof? That's beyond our sense of decorum. I've bloody well had it. I've sat about long enough letting you and Gran and the weight of the damned world keep me pinned, and I'm finished. I don't care. You can take your legacy and your decorum, and you can shove it up your fucking arse, Philip. I'm done.
He huffs out an almighty breath, turns on his heel, and stalks out of the kitchen. Alex, mouth hanging open, remains frozen in his seat for a few seconds. Across from him, Philip is looking red-faced and queasy. Alex clears his throat, stands, and buttons his jacket.
For what it's worth, he says to Philip, that is the bravest son of a bitch I've ever met.
And he leaves, too. Sean looks like he hasn't slept in 36 hours. Well, he looks perfectly composed and groomed, but the tag is sticking out of his sweater, and the strong smell of whiskey is emanating from his tea. Next to him, in the back of the incognito van they're taking to Buckingham Palace, Zara has her arms folded resolutely. The engagement ring on her left hand glints in the muted London morning.
So, Alex attempts. Are you two in a fight now?
Zara looks at him.
No. Why would you think that?
Oh, I just thought because...
It's fine, Sean says, still typing on his phone. This is why we set rules about the personal/professional lines at the outset of the relationship. It works for us.
If you want to fight, you should have seen it when I found out he had known about you two all along, Zara says.
Why do you think I got a rock this big?
It usually works for us, Sean amends.
Yep, Zara agrees. Plus, we banged it out last night. Without looking up, Sean meets her hand at a high five. Sean and Zara's forces combined have managed to secure them a meeting with the Queen at Buckingham Palace. But they've been told to take a winding, circumspect route to avoid the paparazzi. Alex can feel a buzzing static electricity in London this morning. Millions of voices murmuring about him and Henry and what might happen next. But Henry's beside him, holding his hand, and he's holding Henry's hand back. So at least that's something. There's a small, older woman with Bee's upturned nose and Henry's blue eyes waiting outside the conference room when they approach it. She's wearing thick glasses, a worn-in maroon sweater, and a pair of cuffed jeans, looking decidedly out of place in the halls of Buckingham Palace. She has a paperback tucked into her back pocket. Henry's mother turns to face them, and Alex watches her expression flutter through something pained to reserved to gentle when she lays eyes on them. "Hi, my baby," she says as Henry draws up even with her. Henry's jaw is tight, but it's not anger, only fear. Alex can see on his face an expression he recognizes, Henry wondering if it's safe to accept the love offered to him, and wanting desperately to take it regardless. He puts his arm around her, lets her kiss his cheek. "Mom, this is Alex," Henry says, and adds, as if it's not obvious, "My boyfriend." She turns to Alex, and he's honestly not sure what to expect, but she pulls him toward her and kisses his cheek, too. "My Bee has told me what you've done for my son," she says, her gaze piercing. "Thank you." Bee is behind her, looking tired but focused, and Alex can only imagine the come-to-Jesus talk she must have given her mother before they got to the palace. She locks eyes with Zara as their little party assembles in the hall, and Alex feels like they couldn't possibly be in more capable hands. He wonders if Catherine is up to joining the ranks. "What are you going to say to her?" Henry asks his mother. She sighs, touching the edge of her glasses. "Well, the old bird isn't much moved by emotion, so I suppose I'll try to appeal to her with political strategy." Henry blinks. "Sorry, what are you saying?" "I'm saying that I've come to fight," she says, straightforward and plain. "You want to tell the truth, don't you?"
Yeah, Mum.
A light of hope has switched on behind his eyes.
"Yes, I do."
"Then we can try." They take their seats around the long, ornately carved table in the meeting room, awaiting the Queen's arrival in nervous silence. Philip is there, looking like he's about to chew through his tongue, and Henry can't stop fidgeting with his tie. Queen Mary glides in, wearing slate-gray separates and a stony expression, her gray bob arranged with razor precision around the edges of her face. Alex is struck by how tall she is, straight-backed and fine-jawed even in her early 80s. She's not exactly beautiful, but there's a definite story in her shrewd blue eyes and angular features, the heavy creases of frowns around her mouth. The temperature in the room drops as she takes her seat at the head of the table. A royal attendant fetches the teapot from the center of the table and pours into the pristine china, and the quiet hangs as she fixes her tea at a glacial pace, making them wait. The milk, poured with one gently tremoring, ancient hand, one cube of sugar, picked up with deliberate care with the tiny silver tongs, a second cube. Alex coughs. Sean shoots him a look. Bee presses her lips together.
"I had a visit earlier this year," the Queen says at last.
She takes up her teaspoon and begins to stir slowly.
"The President of China. You forgive me if the name escapes me. But he told me the most fascinating story about how technology has advanced in different parts of the world for these modern times. Did you know one can manipulate a photograph to make it appear as if the most outlandish things are real? Just a simple program, is it? A computer, and any manner of unbelievable falsehood could be made actual. One's eyes could hardly detect a difference."
The silence in the room is total, except for the sound of the Queen's teaspoon scraping circular motions in the bottom of her teacup.
"I'm afraid I am too old to understand how things are filed away in space," she goes on, "but I have been told any number of lies can be manufactured and disseminated. One could create files that never existed and plant them somewhere easy to find. None of it real. The most flagrant of evidence can be discredited and dismissed, just like that. With a delicate tinkling of silver on porcelain, she rests her spoon on the saucer and finally looks at Henry. I wonder, Henry, I wonder if you think any of this had to do with those unseemly reports. It's right on the table between them. An offer. Keep ignoring it. Pretend it was a lie. Make it all go away. Henry grits his teeth. It's real, he says. All of it. The Queen's face moves through a series of expressions, settling on a terse frown, as if she's found something unsightly on the bottom of one of her kitten heels. Very well. In that case. Her gaze shifts to Alex. Alexander, had I known you were involved with my grandson, I would have insisted upon a more formal first meeting. Gran, do be quiet, Henry dear. Catherine speaks up then. Mum. The Queen holds up one wizened hand to silence her. I thought we had been humiliated enough in the papers when Beatrice had her little problem. And I made myself clear, Henry, years ago, that if you were drawn in unnatural directions, appropriate measures would be taken. Why you have chosen to undermine the hard work I've done to maintain the crown standing is beyond me, and why you seem set on disrupting my efforts to restore it by demanding I summit with some boy. Here, a nasty lilt to her polite tone, under which Alex can hear epithets for everything from his race to his sexuality, when you were told to await orders, is truly a mystery. Clearly you have taken leave of your senses. My position is unchanged, dear. Your role in this family is to perpetuate our bloodline and maintain the appearance of the monarchy as the ideal of British excellence, and I simply cannot allow anything less. Henry is looking down, eyes distant and cast toward the grain of the table, and Alex can practically feel the energy rolling up from Catherine across from him. An answer to the fury tight in his own chest. The princess who ran away with James Bond, who told her children to give back what their country stole, making a choice. Mum, she says evenly, don't you think we ought to at least have a conversation about other options? The Queen's head turns slowly. And what options might those be, Catherine? Well, I think there's something to be said for coming clean. It could save us a great deal of face to treat it not as a scandal, but as an intrusion upon the privacy of the family and the victimization of a young man in love. Which is what it was, B chimes in. We could integrate this into our narrative, Catherine says, choosing her words with extreme precision. Reclaim the dignity of it. Make Alex an official suitor. I see. So your plan is to allow him to choose this life. Here, a slight tell. It's the only life for him that's honest, Mum. The Queen purses her lips. Henry, she says, returning to him, wouldn't you have a more pleasant go of it without all these unnecessary complications? You know we have the resources to find a wife for you and compensate her handsomely. You understand, I'm only trying to protect you. I know it seems important to you in this moment, but you really must think of the future. You do realize this would mean years of reporters hounding you, all sorts of allegations. I can't imagine people would be as eager to welcome you into children's hospitals. Stop it! Henry bursts out. All the eyes in the room swivel to him, and he looks pale and shocked at the sound of his own voice, but he goes on. You can't intimidate me into submission forever. Alex's hand gropes across the space between them under the table, and the moment his fingertips catch on the back of Henry's wrist, Henry's hand is gripping his hard. I know it will be difficult, Henry says. It's terrifying. And if you'd asked me a year ago, I probably would have said it was fine, that nobody needs to know. But I'm as much a person and a part of this family as you. I deserve to be happy as much as any of you do. And I don't think I ever will be if I have to spend my whole life pretending. Nobody says you don't deserve to be happy, Philip cuts in.
First love makes everyone mad. It's foolish to throw away your future because of one hormonal decision based on less than a year of your life when you were barely in your 20s.
Henry looks Philip square in the face and says, I've been gay as a maypole since the day I came out of Mum, Philip.
In the silence that follows, Alex has to bite down very hard on his tongue to suppress the urge to laugh hysterically.
Well, the Queen eventually says.
She's holding her teacup daintily in the air, eyeing Henry over it.
Even if you're willing to submit to the flogging in the papers, it doesn't erase the stipulations of your birthright. You are to produce heirs.
And Alex apparently hasn't been biting his tongue hard enough, because he blurts out, We could still do that. Even Henry's head whips around at that.
I don't recall giving you permission to speak in my presence, Queen Mary says.
Mum.
That raises the issue of surrogates or donors, Phillips jumps back in, and writes to the throne.
Are those details pertinent right now, Philip?
Catherine interrupts.
Someone has to bear the stewardship for the royal legacy, Mum.
I don't care for that tone at all. We can entertain hypotheticals, but the fact of the matter is that anything but maintaining the royal image is out of the question,
the Queen says, setting down her teacup.
The country simply will not accept a prince of his proclivities. I am sorry, dear, but to them it's perverse.
Perverse to them or perverse to you? Catherine asks her.
That isn't fair, Philip says.
It's my life, Henry interjects. We haven't even gotten a chance yet to see how people will react. I have been serving this country for 47 years, Catherine. I believe I know its heart by now. As I have told you since you were a little girl, you must remove your head from the clouds.
Oh, will you all shut up for a second?
B says. She's standing now, brandishing Sean's tablet in one hand.
Look!
She thunks it down on the table so Queen Mary and Philip can see it, and the rest of them stand to look too. It's a news report from the BBC, and the sound is off, but Alex reads the scroll at the bottom of the screen. Worldwide support pours in for Prince Henry and First Son of US. The room falls silent at the images on the screen. A rally in New York outside the Beekman, decked out in rainbows, with waving signs that say things like, First Son of Our Hearts. A banner on the side of a bridge in Paris that reads, Henry and Alex were here. A hasty mural on a wall in Mexico City of Alex's face in blue, purple, and pink, a crown on his head. A herd of people in Hyde Park with rainbow Union Jacks and Henry's face ripped out of magazines and pasted onto poster boards reading, Free Henry. A young woman with a buzz cut throwing two fingers up at the windows of the Daily Mail. A crowd of teenagers in front of the White House wearing homemade t-shirts that all say the same thing in crooked Sharpie letters, a phrase he recognizes from one of his own emails. History, huh? Alex tries to swallow, but he can't. He looks up, and Henry is looking back at him, mouth open, eyes wet. Princess Catherine turns and crosses the room slowly toward the tall windows on the east side of the room.
Catherine, don't, the Queen says. But Catherine grabs the heavy curtains with both hands and throws them open.
A burst of sunlight and color pushes the air out of the room. Down on the mall in front of Buckingham Palace, there's a mass of people with banners, signs, American flags, Union Jacks, pride pennants streaming over their heads. It's not as big as the royal wedding crowd, but it's huge, filling up the pavement and pressed up to the gates. Alex and Henry were told to come in through the back of the palace. They never saw it. Henry has carefully approached the window, and Alex watches him across the room as he reaches out and grazes his fingertips against the glass. Catherine turns to him and says on a shaky sigh,
Oh, my love.
And pulls him into her chest somehow, even though he's nearly a foot taller. Alex has to look away. Even after everything, this feels too private for him to witness. The Queen clears her throat.
This is hardly representative of how the country as a whole will respond,
she says.
Jesus Christ, Mum,
Catherine says, releasing Henry and nudging him behind her on protective reflex.
This is precisely why I didn't want you to see. You're too soft-hearted to accept the truth, Catherine, given any other option. The majority of this country still wants the ways of old.
Catherine draws herself up, her posture ramrod straight as she approaches the table again. It's a product of royal breeding, but it comes off more like a bow being drawn.
Of course they do, Mum. Of course the bloody Tories in Kensington and the Brexit fools don't want it. That's not the point. Are you so determined to believe nothing could change? That nothing should change? We can have a real legacy here of hope and love and change, not the same tepid shite and drudgery we've been selling since World War II.
You will not speak to me this way,
Queen Mary says icily, one tremulous ancient hand still resting on her teaspoon.
I'm 60 years old, Mum, Catherine says. Can't we eschew decorum at this point?
No respect, never an ounce of respect for the sanctity.
Or perhaps I should bring some of my concerns to Parliament,
Catherine says, leaning in to lower her voice right in Queen Mary's face. Alex recognizes the glint in her eyes.
He never knew. He always assumed Henry got it from his dad. You know, I do think Labour is rather finished with the old guard. I wonder if I were to mention those meetings you keep forgetting about, or the names of the countries you can't quite keep straight, if they might decide that 47 is perhaps enough years for the people of Britain to expect you to serve.
The tremor in the Queen's hand has doubled, but her jaw is steely. The room is deadly silent.
You wouldn't dare.
Wouldn't I, Mum?
Would you like to find out?
Catherine turns to face Henry, and Alex is surprised to see tears on her face.
I'm sorry, Henry, she says. I've failed you. I've failed all of you. You needed your mum, and I wasn't there. And I was so frightened that I started to think maybe it was for the best, to let you all be kept behind glass.
She turns back to her mother.
Look at them, Mum. They're not props of a legacy. They're my children, and I swear on my life and Arthur's, I will take you off the throne before I will let them feel the things you made me feel.
The room hangs in suspense for a few agonizing seconds. Then,
I still don't think, Philip begins, but B seizes the pot of tea from the corner of the table and dumps it into his lap.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry, Pip,
she says, grabbing him by the shoulders and shoving him, sputtering and yelping, toward the door.
So dreadfully clumsy. You know, I think all that cocaine I did must have really done a job on my reflexes. Let's go get you cleaned up, shall we?
She heaves him out, throwing Henry a thumbs up over her shoulder, and shuts the door behind them. The Queen looks over at Alex and Henry, and Alex sees it in her eyes at last. She's afraid of them. She's afraid of the threat they pose to the perfect Fabergé veneer she spent her whole life maintaining. They terrify her. And Catherine isn't backing down.
Well, Queen Mary says, I suppose you don't leave me much choice, do you?
Oh, you have a choice, Mum, Catherine says. You've always had a choice. Perhaps today you'll make the right one.
In the corridor of Buckingham Palace, as soon as the door has shut behind them, they fall sideways into a tapestry on a wall, breathless and delirious and laughing, cheeks wet. Henry pulls Alex close and kisses him, whispers,
I love you, I love you, I love you.
And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if anyone sees. He's on the way back to the airstrip when he sees it, emblazoned on the side of a brick building, a shock of color against a gray street.
Wait, Alex yells up to the driver. Stop! Stop the car!
Up close, it's beautiful. 2 stories tall. He can't imagine how somebody was able to put together something like this so fast. It's a mural of himself and Henry facing each other,
haloed by a bright yellow sun, depicted as Han and Leia. Henry in all white, starlight in his hair, Alex dressed as a scruffy smuggler, a blaster at his hip, a royal and a rebel, arms around each other. He snaps a photo on his phone, and fingers shaking, types out a tweet. Never tell me the odds. He calls June from the air over the Atlantic. I need your help, he says. He hears the click of her pen cocking on the other end of the line. What you got? Chapter 14. Tweet at Jezebel. Watch DC Dykes on Bikes chase protesters from Westboro Baptist Church down Pennsylvania Avenue, and yes, it's as amazing as it sounds. 9:15 p.m., September 29th, 2020. The very first time Alex pulled up to Pennsylvania Avenue, as the first son of the United States, he almost fell into a bush. He can remember it vividly, even though the whole day was surreal. He remembers the interior of the limo, how he was still unused to the way the leather felt under his clammy palms, still green and jittery, and pressed too close to the window to look at all the crowds. He remembers his mother, her long hair pulled back from her face in an elegant, no-nonsense twist at the back of her head. She'd worn it down for her first day as mayor, her first day in the House, her first day as speaker. But that day, it was up. She said she didn't want any distractions. He thought it made her look tough, like she was ready for a brawl if it came down to it, as if she might have a razor in her shoe. She sat there across from him, going over the notes for her speech, a 24-karat gold American flag on her lapel, and Alex was so proud he thought he'd throw up. There was a changeover at some point. Ellen and Leo escorted to the north entrance, and Alex and June shuffled off in another direction. He remembers very specifically a handful of things. His cufflinks, custom sterling silver X-wings, a tiny scuff in the plaster of the western wall of the White House, which he was seeing up close for the first time. His own shoelace, untied. And he remembers bending over to tie his shoe, losing his balance because of nerves, and June grabbing the back of his jacket to keep him from plunging face first into a thorny rosebush in front of 75 cameras. That was the moment he decided he wasn't going to allow himself nerves ever again. Not as Alex Claremont Diaz, first son of the United States, and not as Alex Claremont Diaz, rising political star. Now, he's Alex Claremont Diaz, center of an international political sex scandal and boyfriend of a Prince of England, and he's back in a limo on Pennsylvania Avenue. And there's another crowd. And the imminent barf feeling is back. When the car door opens, it's June, standing there in a bright yellow t-shirt that says, History, huh? You like it? She says. There's a guy selling them down the block. I got his card. I'm gonna put it in my next column for Vogue. Alex launches himself at her, engulfing her in a hug that lifts her feet off the ground, and she yelps and pulls his hair, and they topple sideways into a shrub, as Alex was always destined to do. Their mother is in a decathlon of meetings, so they sneak out onto Truman Balcony and catch each other up over hot chocolates and a plate of donuts. Pez has been trying to play telephone between the respective camps, but it's only so effective. June cries first when she hears about the phone call on the plane. Then again at Henry standing up to Philip, and a third time at the crowd outside Buckingham Palace. Alex watches her text Henry about 100 heart emojis, and he sends her back a short video of himself and Catherine drinking champagne while B plays God Save the Queen on electric guitar. Okay. Here's the thing, June says afterward. Nobody has seen Nora in 2 days. Alex stares at her. What do you mean? I mean, I've called her, Zara's called her, Mike and her parents have all called her. She's not answering anyone. The guard at her apartment says she hasn't left this whole time. Apparently, she's fine but busy. I tried just showing up, but she's told the doorman not to let me in. That's concerning. And also, kind of shitty. Yeah, I know. Alex turns away, pacing over to the railing. He really could have used Nora's nonplussed approach in this situation. Or really, just his best friend's company. He feels somewhat betrayed she's abandoned him when he needs her most, when he and June both need her most. She has a tendency to bury herself in complex calculations on purpose when especially bad things happen around her. "Oh, hey," June says, "and here's the favor you asked for." She reaches into the pocket of her jeans and hands him a folded-up piece of paper. He skims the first few lines. "Oh my God, Bug," he says. Oh my God. "Do you like it?" She looks a little nervous. "I was trying to capture, like, who you are and your place in history and what your role means to you, and..." She's cut off because he scooped her up in another bear hug, teary-eyed. "It's perfect, June." "Hey, first offspring," says a voice suddenly, and when Alex puts June down, Amy is waiting in the doorway connecting the balcony to the oval room. "Madam President wants to see you in her office." Her attention shifts, listening to her earpiece. She says to bring the donuts. "How does she always know?" June mutters, scooping up the plate. "I have Blue Bonnet and Barracuda on the move," Amy says, touching her earpiece. "I still can't believe you picked that for your stupid code name," June says to him. Alex trips her on the way through the door. The donuts have been gone for 2 hours. One on the couch, June tying and untying and retying the laces on her keds, for lack of anything else to do with her hands. Two against a far wall, Zara rapidly typing out an email on her phone, then another. Three at the Resolute desk, Ellen buried in probability projections. Four on the other couch, Alex, counting. The doors to the Oval Office fly open, and Nora comes careening in. She's wearing a bleach-stained Hollerin' for Congress 72 sweatshirt and the frenzied, sun-blinded expression of someone who has emerged from a doomsday bunker for the first time in a decade. She nearly crashes into the bust of Abraham Lincoln in a rush to Ellen's desk. Alex is already on his feet. "Where the fuck have you been?" She slaps a thick folder down on the desk and turns halfway to face Alex and June, out of breath. "Okay, I know you're pissed, and you have every right to be, but..." She braces herself against the desk with both hands, gesturing toward the folder with her chin. "I have been holed up in my apartment for 2 days doing this, and you are super not going to be mad at me anymore when you see what it is." Alex's mother blinks at her, perturbed. "Nora, honey, we're trying to figure out..." "Ellen!" Nora practically yells. The room goes silent, and Nora freezes, realizing. Ma'am, mom-in-law, please, just... You need to read this." Alex watches her sigh and put down her pen before pulling the folder toward her. Nora looks like she's about to pass out on top of the desk. He looks across to June on the opposite couch, who appears as clueless as he feels, and... "Holy fucking shit," his mother says, a dawning mix of fury and bemusement. "Is this..." "Yup," Nora says. "And the uh-huh?" Ellen covers her mouth with one hand. "How the hell did you get this? Wait, let me rephrase. How the hell did you get this?" "Okay, so..." Nora withdraws herself from the desk and steps backward. Alex has no idea what the fuck is happening, but it's something, something big. Nora is pacing now, both hands clutched to her forehead. "The day of the leak, I get an anonymous email. Obvious sock puppet account, but untraceable. I tried. They sent me a link to a fucking massive file dump and told me they were a hacker and had obtained the contents of the Richards campaign's private email server in their entirety." Alex stares at her. "What?" Nora looks back at him. "I know." Zara, who has been standing behind Ellen's desk with her arms folded, cuts in to ask, "And you didn't report this to any of the proper channels because... Because I wasn't sure it was anything at first. And when it was, I didn't trust anybody else to handle it. They said they sent it specifically to me because they knew I was personally invested in Alex's situation and would work as fast as possible to find out what they didn't have time to." "Which is?" Alex can't believe he still has to ask. "Proof," Nora says, and her voice is shaking now, "that Richards fucking set you up."
He hears, distantly, the sound of June swearing under her breath and getting up from the couch, walking off to the far corner of the room. His knees give out, so he sits back down.
We suspected that maybe the RNC had somehow been involved with some of what happened, his mother says.
She's coming around the desk now, kneeling on the floor in front of him in her starched gray dress, the folder held against her chest.
I had people looking into it. I never imagined. The whole thing. Straight from Richards's campaign.
She takes the folder and spreads it open on the coffee table in the middle of the room.
There were, I mean, just hundreds of thousands of emails, Nora is saying as Alex climbs down onto the rug and starts staring at the pages, and I swear a third of them were from dummy accounts, but I wrote a code that narrowed it down to about 3,000. I went through the rest manually. This is everything about Alex and Henry.
Alex notices his own face first. It's a photo, blurry, out of focus, caught on a long-range lens, only barely recognizable. It's hard to place where he is, until he sees the elegant ivory curtains at the edge of the frame. Henry's bedroom. He looks above the photo and sees it's attached to an email between two people.
Negative. Nilsson says that's not nearly clear enough. You need to tell the P we're not paying for Bigfoot sightings.
Nilsson. Nilsson, as in Richards' campaign manager.
Richards outed you, Alex, Nora says. As soon as you left the campaign, it started. He hired a firm that hired the hackers who got the surveillance tapes from the Beekman.
His mother is next to him with a highlighter cap already between her teeth, slashing bright yellow lines across pages. There's movement to his right. Zara is there too, pulling a stack of papers toward her and starting in with a red pen.
I don't have any bank account numbers or anything, but if you look, there are pay stubs and invoices and requests of service, Nora says. Everything, guys. It's all through back channels and go-between firms and fake names, but there's a digital paper trail for everything. Enough for a federal investigation, which could subpoena the financial stuff, I think.
Basically, Richards hired a firm that hired the photographers who followed Alex and the hackers who breached your server, and then he hired another third party to buy everything and resell it to the Daily Mail.
I mean, we're talking about having private contractors surveil a member of the First Family and infiltrate White House security to try to induce a sex scandal to win a presidential race. That is some fucked up shit.
Nora, can you, June says, suddenly having returned to one of the couches, just, please?
Sorry, Nora says. She sits down heavily. I drank like 9 Red Bulls to get through all of those and ate a weed gummy to level back out, so I'm flying at fasten seatbelts right now.
Alex closes his eyes.
There's so fucking much in front of him, and it's impossible to process it all right now, and he's pissed, furious. But he can also put a name on it. He can do something about it.
He can go outside. He can walk out of this office and call Henry and tell him, we're safe. The worst is over. He opens his eyes again, looks down at the pages on the table.
What do we do with this now? June asks.
What if we just leaked it? Alex offers. WikiLeaks.
I'm not giving them shit.
Ellen cuts him off immediately, not even looking up, especially not after what they did to you.
This is real shit. I'm taking this motherfucker down. It has to stick.
She finally puts her highlighter down.
We're leaking it to the press.
No major publication is going to run this without verification from someone on the Richards campaign that these emails are real, June points out.
And that kind of thing takes months.
Nora, Ellen says, fixing her with a steely gaze.
Is there anything you can do at all to trace the person who sent this to you?
I tried, Nora says. They did everything to obscure their identity. She reaches down into her shirt and produces her phone.
I can show you the email they sent.
She swipes through a few screens and places her phone face up on the table. The email is exactly as she described, with a signature at the bottom that's apparently a random combination of numbers and letters. 2021 SCB BAC CHZ GRON A1.
2021 SCB.
Alex's eyes stop on the last line. He picks up the phone, stares at it.
God damn it.
He keeps staring at the stupid letters. 2021 SCB. 2021 South Colorado Boulevard. The closest Five Guys to the office where he worked that summer in Denver. He still remembers the order he was sent out to pick up at least once a week. Bacon cheeseburger, grilled onions, A1 sauce. Alex memorized the goddamn Five Guys order. He feels himself start to laugh. It's code. For Alex and Alex only. You're the only one I trust. This isn't a hacker, Alex says. Rafael Luna sent this to you. That's your verification. He looks at his mother. If you can protect him, he'll confirm it for you. Musical introduction. 15-second instrumental from Destiny's Child's 1999 single, Bills, Bills, Bills. Voiceover. This is a Range Audio podcast. You're listening to Bills, 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 hosted by Oliver Westbrook, professor of constitutional law at NYU. End musical introduction. Westbrook. Hi, I'm Oliver Westbrook, and with me as always is my exceedingly patient, talented, merciful, and lovely producer, Sophia, without whom I would be lost, bereft, floating on a sea of bad thoughts and drinking my own piss. We love her. Say hi, Sophia. Sophia Jarwar, producer, Range Audio.
Hello. Please send help.
Westbrook. And this is Bills, 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 the podcast where I attempt every week to break down for you, in layman's terms, what happened in Congress, why you should care, and what you can do about it. Well, I gotta tell you guys, I had a very different show planned out a few days ago, but I don't really see the point in getting into any of it. Let's just, take a minute to review the story the Washington Post broke this morning. We've got emails, anonymously leaked, confirmed by an anonymous source on the Richards campaign, that clearly show Jeffrey Richards, or at least high-ranking staffers at his campaign, orchestrated this fucking diabolical plan to have Alex Claremont Diaz stalked, surveilled, hacked, and outed by the Daily Mail as part of an effort to take down Ellen Claremont in the general. And then, about, 40 minutes? 40 minutes before we started recording this, Senator Rafael Luna tweeted he was parting ways with the Richards campaign. So, wow. I don't think there's any need to discuss a leak from the campaign other than Luna. It's obviously him. From where I sit, this looks like the case of a man who, maybe he didn't really want to be there in the first place. Maybe he was already having second thoughts. Maybe he even infiltrated the campaign to do something exactly like this. Sophia, am I allowed to say that?
Jarwar. Literally, when has that ever stopped you?
Westbrook. Point. Anyway, Casper Mattresses is paying me the big sponsorship bucks to give you a Washington analysis podcast, so I'm going to attempt to do that here. Even though what has happened to Alex Claremont Diaz, and Prince Henry too, over the past few days, has been obscene. And it feels cheap and gross to even talk about it like this. But in my opinion, here are the three big things to take away from the news we've gotten today. First, the first son of the United States didn't actually do anything wrong. Second, Jeffrey Richards committed a hostile act of conspiracy against a sitting president, and I am eagerly awaiting the federal investigation that is coming to him once he loses this election. Third, Rafael Luna is perhaps the unlikeliest hero of the 2020 presidential race. A speech has to be made. Not just a statement, a speech.
You wrote this?
Their mother says, holding the folded-up page June had handed Alex on the balcony.
Alex told you to scrap the statement our press secretary drafted and write this whole thing?
June bites her lip and nods.
This is good, June. Why the hell aren't you writing all our speeches?
The press briefing room in the West Wing is ruled too impersonal, so they've called the press pool to the diplomatic reception room on the ground floor. It's the room where FDR once recorded his fireside chats, and Alex is going to walk in there and make a speech and hope the country doesn't hate him for the truth. They've flown Henry in from London for the telecast. He'll be positioned right at Alex's shoulder, steady and sure. The emblematic politician's spouse. Alex's brain can't stop sprinting laps around it. He keeps picturing it, an hour from now, millions and millions of TVs across America simulcasting his face, his voice, June's words, Henry at his side. Everyone will know. Everyone already knows now, but they don't know. Not the right way. In an hour, every person in America will be able to look at a screen and see their first son and his boyfriend. And across the Atlantic, almost as many will look up over a beer at a pub, or dinner with their family, or a quiet night in, and see their youngest prince, the most beautiful one, Prince Charming. This is it. October 2nd, 2020. And the whole world watched, and history remembered. Alex waits on the south lawn, within view of the linden trees of the Kennedy Garden, where they first kissed. Marine One touches down in a cacophony of noise and wind and rotors, and Henry emerges in head-to-toe Burberry, looking dramatic and windswept. Like a dashing hero, here to rip bodices and mend war-torn countries, and Alex has to laugh.
What?
Henry shouts over the noise when he sees the look on Alex's face.
My life is a cosmic joke, and you're not a real person,
Alex says, wheezing.
What?
Henry yells again.
I said you look great, baby!
They sneak off to make out in a stairwell until Zara finds them and drags Henry off to get camera ready. And soon, they're being shuffled to the diplomatic reception room. And it's time. It's time. It's been one long, long year of learning Henry inside and out. Learning himself. Learning how much he still had to learn. And just like that, it's time to walk out there and stand at a podium and confidently declare it all as fact. He's not afraid of anything he feels. He's not afraid of saying it. He's only afraid of what happens when he does. Henry touches his hand, gently, two fingertips against his palm. 5 minutes for the rest of our lives, he says, laughing a grim little laugh. Alex reaches for him in return, presses one thumb into the hollow of his collarbone, slipping right under the knot of his tie. The tie is purple silk, and Alex is counting his breaths. You are, he says, the absolute worst idea I've ever had. Henry's mouth spreads into a slow smile, and Alex kisses it. First son, Alexander Claremont Diaz's address from the White House, October 2nd, 2020. Good morning. I am, and have been, first, last, and always, a child of America. You raised me. I grew up in the pastures and hills of Texas, but I had been to 34 states before I learned how to drive. When I caught the stomach flu in the fifth grade, my mother sent a note to school written on the back of a holiday memo from Vice President Biden. Sorry, sir. We were in a rush, and it was the only paper she had on hand. I spoke to you for the first time when I was 18, on the stage of the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, when I introduced my mother as the nominee for president. You cheered for me. I was young and full of hope, and you let me embody the American dream. That a boy who grew up speaking two languages, whose family was blended and beautiful and enduring, could make a home for himself in the White House. You pinned the flag to my lapel and said, "We're rooting for you." As I stand before you today, my hope is that I have not let you down. Years ago, I met a prince, and though I didn't realize it at the time, his country had raised him too. The truth is, Henry and I have been together since the beginning of this year.
The truth is, as many of you have read, we have both struggled every day with what this means for our families, our countries, and our futures. The truth is, we have both had to make compromises that cost us sleep at night in order to afford us enough time to share our relationship with the world on our own terms. We were not afforded that liberty. But the truth is, also, simply this. Love is indomitable. America has always believed this. And so, I am not ashamed to stand here today where presidents have stood and say that I love him. The same as Jack loved Jackie. The same as Lyndon loved Lady Bird. Every person who bears a legacy makes the choice of a partner with whom they will share it, whom the American people will hold beside them in their hearts and memories and history books. America, he is my choice. Like countless other Americans, I was afraid to say this out loud because of what the consequences might be. To you specifically, I say, I see you. I am one of you. As long as I have a place in this White House, so will you. I am the first son of the United States, and I'm bisexual. History will remember us. If I can ask only one thing of the American people, it's this. Please, do not let my actions influence your decision in November. The decision you will make this year is so much bigger than anything I could ever say or do, and it will determine the fate of this country for years to come. My mother, your president, is the warrior and the champion that each and every American deserves for 4 more years of growth, progress, and prosperity. Please don't let my actions send us backward. I ask the media not to focus on me or on Henry, but on the campaign, on policy, on the lives and livelihoods of millions of Americans at stake in this election. And finally, I hope America will remember that I am still the son you raised. My blood still runs from Lomita, Texas, and San Diego, California, and Mexico City. I still remember the sound of your voices from that stage in Philadelphia. I wake up every morning thinking of your hometowns, of the families I've met at rallies in Idaho and Oregon and South Carolina. I have never hoped to be anything other than what I was to you then, and what I am to you now. The first son. Yours, in actions and words. And I hope, when Inauguration Day comes again in January, I will continue to be. The first 24 hours after the speech are a blur, but a few snapshots will stay with him for the rest of his life. A picture, the morning after, a new crowd gathered on the mall, the biggest yet. He stays in the residence for safety, but he and Henry and June and Nora and all 3 of his parents sit in the living room on the 2nd floor and watch the live stream on CNN. In the middle of the broadcast, Amy, at the front of the cheering crowd, wearing June's yellow "History, huh?" t-shirt and a trans flag pin. Next to her, Cash, with Amy's wife on his shoulders in what Alex can now tell is the jean jacket Amy was embroidering on the plane in the colors of the pansexual flag. He whoops so hard he spills his coffee on George Bush's favorite rug. A picture. Senator Jeffrey Richards' stupid Sam the Eagle face on CNN, talking about his grave concern for President Claremont's ability to remain impartial on matters of traditional family values due to the acts her son engages in on the sacred grounds of the house our forefathers built. Followed by Senator Oscar Diaz, responding via satellite, that President Claremont's primary value is upholding the Constitution, and that the White House was built by slaves, not our forefathers. A picture. The expression on Rafael Luna's face when he looks up from his paperwork to see Alex standing in the doorway of his office. "Why do you even have a staff?" Alex says. "Nobody has ever tried to stop me from walking straight in here." Luna has his reading glasses on, and he looks like he hasn't shaved in weeks. He smiles, a little apprehensive.
After Alex decoded the message in the email, his mother called Luna directly and told him, no questions asked, she would grant him full protection from criminal charges if he helped her take Richards down. He knows his dad has been in touch, too. Luna knows neither of his parents are holding a grudge, but this is the first time they've spoken.
If you think I don't tell every hire on their first day that you have a free pass, he says, you do not have an accurate sense of yourself.
Alex grins, and he reaches into his pocket and produces a packet of Skittles, lobbing them underhand onto Luna's desk. Luna looks down at them. The chair is next to his desk these days, and he pushes it out. Alex hasn't gotten a chance to thank him yet, and he doesn't know where to start. He doesn't even feel like it's the first order of business. He watches Luna rip open the packet and dump the candy out onto his papers. There's a question hanging in the air, and they can both see it. Alex doesn't want to ask. They just got Luna back. He's afraid of losing him again to the answer. But he has to know.
Did you know? He finally says. Before it happened, did you know what he was going to do?
Luna takes his glasses off and sets them down grimly on his blotter.
Alex, I know I completely destroyed your faith in me, so I don't blame you for asking me, he says.
He leans forward on his elbows, his eye contact hard and deliberate.
But I need you to know I would never, ever intentionally let something like that happen to you. Ever. I had no idea until it came out. Same as you.
Alex releases a long breath.
Okay, he says.
He watches Luna lean back, looks at the fine lines on his face, slightly heavier than they were before.
So what happened?
Luna sighs, a hoarse, tired sound in the back of his throat. It's a sound that makes Alex think about what his dad told him at the lake, about how much of Luna is hidden.
So, he says, you know I interned for Richards.
Alex blinks.
What?
Luna barks a small, humorless laugh.
Yeah, you wouldn't have heard. Richards made pretty damn sure to get rid of the evidence. But yeah, 2000. I was 19. It was back when he was AG in Utah. One of my professors called in a favor.
There were rumors, Luna explains, among the low-level staffers. Usually the female interns, but occasionally an especially pretty boy. A boy like him. Promises from Richards. Mentorship. Connections. If you just get a drink with me after work. A strong implication that no was unacceptable.
I had nothing back then, Luna says. No money, no family, no connections, no experience. I thought, this is your only way to get your foot in the door. Maybe he means it.
Luna pauses, taking a breath. Alex's stomach is twisting uncomfortably.
He sent a car, made me meet him at a hotel, got me drunk. He wanted. He tried to.
Luna grimaces away from finishing the sentence.
Anyway, I got away. I remember I got home that night, and the guy I was renting a room with took one look at me and handed me a cigarette. That's when I started smoking, by the way.
He's been looking down at the Skittles on his desk, sorting the reds from oranges. But here, he looks up at Alex with a bitter, cutting smile.
And I went back to work the next day like nothing happened. I made small talk with him in the break room because I wanted it to be okay. And that's what I hated myself the most for. So the next time he sent me an email, I walked into his office and told him that if he didn't leave me alone, I'd take it to the paper. And that's when he pulled out the file.
He called it an insurance policy. He knew stuff I did as a teenager. How I got kicked out by my parents and a youth shelter in Seattle. That I have family who are undocumented. He told me that if I ever said a word about what happened, not only would I never have a career in politics, but he would ruin my life. He'd ruin my family's lives. So I shut the fuck up. Luna's eyes, when they meet his again, are ice cold, sharp, A window slammed shut. But I've never forgotten. I'd see him in the Senate chamber, and he'd look at me like I owed him something, because he hadn't destroyed me when he could have. And I knew he was going to do whatever shady shit it took to win the presidency, and I couldn't let a fucking predator be the most powerful man in the country if it was within my power to stop it. He turns now, a tiny shake of his shoulders like he's dusting off a light snowfall, pivoting his chair to pluck up a few Skittles and pop them into his mouth. And he's trying for casual, but his hands aren't steady. He explains that the moment he decided was this summer, when he saw Richards on TV talking about the Youth Congress program, that he knew with more access he could find and leak evidence of abuse. Even if he was too old for Richards to want to fuck, he could play him, convince him he didn't believe Ellen would win, that he'd get the Hispanic and moderate vote in exchange for power. I fucking hated myself every minute of working with that campaign, but I spent the whole time looking for evidence. I was close. I was so focused, so zeroed in that I never noticed if there were whispers about you. I had no idea. But when everything came out, I knew. I just couldn't prove it. But I had access to the servers. I don't know much, but I've been around the block enough in my teenage anarchist days to know people who know how to do a file dump. Don't look at me like that. I'm not that old. Alex laughs, and Luna laughs too. And it's a relief, like the air coming back in the room. Anyway, getting it straight to you and your mother was the fastest way to expose him, and I knew Nora could do that. And I knew you would understand. He pauses, sucking on a Skittle, and Alex decides to ask. Did my dad know? About me going triple agent? No, nobody does. Half my staff quit because they didn't know. My sister hasn't spoken to me in months. No, about what Richards did to you. Alex, your father is the only person alive I've ever told any of this to, he says. Your father took it upon himself to help me when I wouldn't let anyone else, and I'll never stop being grateful to him. But he wanted me to come forward with what Richards did to me, and I couldn't. I said it was a risk I wasn't willing to take with my own career, but truthfully, I didn't think what happened to one gay Mexican kid 20 years ago would make a difference to his base. I didn't think anyone would believe me. I believe you, Alex says readily. I just wish you would have told me what you were doing, or like, anybody. You would have tried to stop me, Luna says. You all would have. I mean, Raph, it was a fucking crazy plan. I know. And I don't know if I'll ever be able to fix the damage I've done. But I honestly don't care. I did what I had to do. There was no way in hell I was going to let Richards win. My whole life has been about fighting. I fought. Alex thinks it over. He can relate. It echoes the same deliberations he's been having with himself. He thinks of something he hasn't allowed himself to think about since all this started after London. His LSAT results, unopened and tucked away inside the desk in his bedroom. How do you do all the good you can do? I'm sorry, by the way, Luna says, for the things I said to you. He doesn't have to specify which things. I was fucked up. It's cool, Alex tells him, and he means it. He forgave Luna before he ever walked into the office, but he appreciates the apology. I'm sorry, too. But also, I hope you know that if you ever call me kid again after all this, I am literally going to kick your ass. Luna laughs in earnest. Listen, you've had your first big sex scandal. No more sitting at the kids' table. Alex nods appreciatively, stretching in his chair and folding his hands behind his head. Man, it fucking sucks it has to be like this with Richards. Even if you expose him now, straight people always want the homophobic bastards to be closet cases so they can wash their hands of it. As if 99 out of 100 aren't just regular old hateful bigots. Yeah, especially since I think I'm the only male intern he ever took to a hotel. It's the same as any fucking predator. It has nothing to do with sexuality and everything to do with power.
Do you think you'll say anything?
Alex says, at this point.
I've been thinking about it a lot, he leans in. Most people have kind of already figured out that I'm the League. And I think, sooner or later, someone is going to come to me with an allegation that is within the statute of limitations. Then we can open up a congressional investigation, big time. And that will make a difference.
I heard a we in there, Alex says.
Well, Luna says, me and someone else with law experience.
Is that a hint?
It's a suggestion, Luna says, but I'm not going to tell you what to do with your life. I'm busy trying to get my own shit together.
Look at this. He lifts his sleeve.
Nicotine patch, bitch.
No way, Alex says. Are you actually quitting for real?
I am a changed man, unburdened by the demons of my past, Luna says solemnly, with a jerk-off hand gesture.
You fucker. I'm proud of you.
Hola, says a voice at the door of the office.
It's his dad, in a t-shirt and jeans, a six-pack of beer in one hand.
Oscar, Luna says, grinning. We were just talking about how I've decimated my reputation and killed my own political career.
Hey, he says, dragging an extra chair over to the desk and passing out beers. Sounds like a job for Los Bastardos.
Alex cracks open his can. We can also discuss how I might cost Mom the election because I'm a one-man bisexual wrecking ball who exposed the vulnerability of the White House private email server.
You think? His dad says. Nah, come on. I don't think this election is going to hinge on an email server.
Alex arches a brow. You sure about that?